United Nations General Assembly has declared this World Refugee Year to speed up the rehabilitation of these forgotten men, women, and children. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees urges your support of this vital mission. The President of the United States has issued a special proclamation on behalf of the refugee. The United States Committee for Refugees says, help us help the refugee.
Not, of course, 2017, but 1959, and the mellifluous voice of Gregory Peck, one of the most famous Hollywood stars ever to lend his or her voice to UN Radio, and a fitting one to launch this edition of our Lid Is On podcast classic series. The current President of the United States has a different take, but back then it was the former First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, whose husband gave America the New Deal in the 1930s, in front of the mic here at UN headquarters, illuminating the plight of refugees.
To focus attention on the problems of the refugee, step by step to alleviate the problems, that's what World Refugee Year is all about.
You're about to hear the full radio documentary, Life Begins at 10, produced for UN Radio towards the end of Europe's 20th century refugee crisis. We thought it was fascinating how similar and yet different the circumstances and reactions were back then, as the world grapples now with 65 million on the run and rising. To fill in some of the history and assess what this special documentary says about the refugee and migration crisis today, we invited a special guest to join us here on The Lid Is On.
My name is Volker Türk. I'm the Assistant High Commissioner for Refugees, specifically responsible for protection in UNHCR. One of the earliest resolutions of the General Assembly of the UN was in 1946 to speak specifically to the refugee issue. So it was absolutely clear in the wake of the Second World War that among the member states of the United Nations then, the refugee issue was clearly at the forefront of priorities, of consideration, of also learning the lessons from the interwar period and from the Second World War itself. Let's not forget that in the 40s in Europe, you had about 60 million people on the move. And these were refugees, internally displaced people. You had deported populations. I mean, we sometimes forget this when we talk about a million in 2015 that arrived in Europe. But actually, you had millions of people on the move. It led to the foundation of a specialized organization, International Refugee Organization, that actually was there to deal with the aftermath of the refugee situations, displacement situations, as a result of the Second World War, and was there to provide solutions for it. But then it was also realized with the onset of the Cold War that indeed you needed a legal instrument that would consolidate the legal achievements from the interwar period to deal with refugee movements in the future. It was the 1951 Refugee Convention, but then you had 56, again in Europe, you had massive refugee movements as a result of the crisis in Hungary. So you were confronted with a world that came out of a displacement, of a massive displacement experience.
1959 was designated World Refugee Year. Was that a first? Was it the first time that refugees had had such a focus in terms of the UN effort?
It was indeed the first time that the UN declared it in order to focus on the plight of refugees. But it certainly followed developments with the establishment of UNHCR in 1950, with the adoption of the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees. So it followed a number of important developments that in a way led to the declaration of a year that is dedicated to refugee issues. And that was certainly very important as a signal that indeed refugees are a matter of international concern, that the international community needs to deal with them and respond to their needs and needs to find solutions for them.
This is Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt. I'm speaking to you today from one of my favorite buildings, to which I still come now and then to work. It is the United Nations headquarters, New York. I shall be joined today by some interesting people, warm-hearted people, who feel as I do about United Nations Day 1959. They are Doris Day, Joseph Schildkraut, and Gregory Peck. Since 1946, when I attended the first session of the United Nations General Assembly in London, I can think of no project that pleases me more, that is more humanitarian than the United Nations World Refugee Year. On United Nations Day in 1959, we wish to tell you a little about World Refugee Year, which began in June. By 1960, thanks to the cooperation of United Nations member countries, we hope to close all refugee camps, those frightful places which I've seen, which still exist in Europe 14 years after the war. There's more to be done, certainly, but this is a very big start indeed. On UN Day, when many of us pause to think about what the UN is, what it means, and what it does, I want you to hear a story. Though it has music and a very pretty and charming actress to tell it, I assure you it is quite true. The actress is a favorite of mine, Miss Doris Day. But before Miss Day begins, I want you to remember one thing. It is a very difficult thing to be a child growing up in a refugee camp. All that is normal and natural to the young is lacking. You learn to make do, to adjust, but you have no hope, no plan, no dream. One of the reasons I'm so interested in the UN's World Refugee Year program is because thousands of children will be able to dream again. Having said this, I invite you to hear Miss Day in Life Begins at 10.
He was 10 years old, and for 10 years he lived in a refugee camp. In fact, he was born in a refugee camp. Actually, he had known a number of camps, 4 of them, to be exact. For the past 3.5 years, little Janos had been living in the camp at Latina, which is south of Rome on the road to Naples. This camp is set almost in the middle of the town of Latina. And if you walk along the main street, you are likely to hear 3 or 4 Eastern European tongues blending in with Italian. Janos and his mother shared a room at the camp. The father had died 5 years before. 3 years later, Janos's mother first thought of emigrating to a new country. She spoke with officials from the camp, the voluntary agencies, and the office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. But time was going by, and Janos was growing from a baby into a fine big boy. He was a quiet and sensitive child who never complained. Like so many other children who lived in refugee camps, he had learned to adjust himself to many limitations. One day, Janos's mother was called to the camp office, where the UN representative told her that through a voluntary agency, a sponsor had been found, that she and her son would soon be able to leave the camp. As the woman's eyes opened wide, almost in disbelief, the UN man continued. They were going to America, and there would be a home for her and Janos, also a job. Here was the realization of an almost abandoned hope. The UN man continued. There wasn't much time. In fact, she and Janos would be leaving within 5 days. They would fly with other refugees on a plane specially chartered by the Intergovernmental Committee for European Migration, which helps to find resettlement opportunities for refugees. After more than 10 long years in refugee camps, this promise of a new life was almost too much to bear. Janos's mother hurried to tell her son the wonderful news, but when she did, she was bewildered by Janos's reaction. "America is a very long way from here," he said. "Will we like it in America, Mother? Everything is so different." "Oh, I'm sure we will," his mother answered. "You will go to school, and I will work hard for both of us." She paused and looked at him. "You don't seem very excited," she said. Perhaps Janos's mother couldn't quite realize that even a child after an entire lifetime spent in a refugee camp, might have defensively retreated from harsh reality into resignation. On the morning Janos and his mother were to leave, a camp official said to the boy, "Do you know what today is, Janos?" "Yes, it is my birthday," Janos said. "Today I am 10. "Your birthday? Why, you should have a party." With a pathetic shrug, Janos said, "I've never had a party." That night, Janos and his mother and the other refugees were at the in-transit lounge at Rome's Ciampino Airport. Finally, a voice came over the speaker.
"Migration Committee Special Flight for New York. Please board the aircraft. Migration Committee Special Flight for New York. Please board the aircraft."
When the plane was several hours out, the UN official accompanying the group asked Janos, "Do you know what day this is?" "It is my birthday," came the reply. The official gave a signal. A smiling stewardess walked down the aisle with her hands held high. She was carrying a small birthday cake with barely room for 10 lighted candles. "Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Janos. Happy birthday to you." And so, at 15,000 feet over the Atlantic, for the first time in his life, Janos had a birthday party. The voices that sang the familiar music came forth in a half dozen languages. But it made no difference. Janos understood.
In a moment, we are going to hear the voice of another famous singer in a refugee camp in Europe. It is no guest appearance, for this lady lives there. She is a refugee. One of the 14 million throughout the world dependent on the United Nations for at least a part of their subsistence. A man consists of a body, a soul, and a passport. Sir John Hope Simpson of England, a man familiar with refugee problems, said that. And sometimes the passport is the most elusive. To focus attention on the problems of the refugee, step by step to alleviate the problems, that's what World Refugee Year is all about. The singer in the camp is an example. I have asked my good friend and the celebrated actor, Mr. Joseph Schildkraut, to tell us about it.
The bitterest of all the legacies of war and political upheaval, the problem of the refugees. This singer you're listening to, she has a history. There was a time when audiences in one of Europe's great opera houses applauded her. She has not been inside an opera house for some years. Nobody applauded her after that song just now. She sang it and we recorded it in a tiny room with a concrete floor in a refugee camp in Trieste. She lives there as a refugee. What is it like after you've sought refuge in a territory other than that in which you formerly resided? Some, a few, are lucky. But for most, for thousands and thousands, it means a long, slow process of waiting. Of waiting in a camp for a piece of paper, a visa, which means you can move on to a new, productive life. Ask any of those you see how their plans are getting on or when they expect to move on, to emigrate to a new land, Canada, America, Australia, Brazil.
I haven't got my visa yet, but I'm waiting for it.
They're waiting for it? How long have you been waiting for your visa?
Well, I've been waiting here for about 4 years.
4 years. And what makes you think that your visa will be coming soon?
Oh, that's a hope. Everybody's waiting so long for it.
They wait. They wait for a visa. That means there's someone in a foreign land willing to sponsor them, that there'll be work and a home. And while they wait, what can they do? Get sporadic and unrewarding jobs in the vicinity of the camp, washing dishes, perhaps. But what about the hours of darkness when despair swells up inside like a choking fog? The slow erosion of passing time is probably the greatest obstacle, but it's certainly not the only one. The rules of immigration are demanding things. You may not have the required skills. You may be too old at 45. You may just be ill. So what is being done to provide a real chance? The answer, fortunately, is a great deal. By the High Commissioner's Office, by non-governmental organizations, and by individuals in many countries who have responded to the challenge spontaneously, not just with sympathy, no, but with active, practical work. This was recognized when the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the office of the United Nations High Commissioner for the ceaseless effort it is making to find a permanent solution. Yes, the solution of the refugee problem can make a contribution to world peace.
Mr. Schildkraut has stated it well, I think. Now, what can we do to help? 60 nations have coordinated their efforts through the United Nations and World Refugee Year. What can we as individuals do? I should like now to call on Mr. Gregory Peck in Hollywood.
You know what it means to be forgotten? The United Nations General Assembly has declared this World Refugee Year to speed up the rehabilitation of these forgotten men, women, and children. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees urges your support of this vital mission. The President of the United States has issued a special proclamation on behalf of the refugee. The United States Committee for Refugees says, "Help us help the refugee."
The earth is one. There is no place that is good when elsewhere in the world the destitute cry for our attention. When 14 years after the war, there are still homeless, unwanted refugees. What is it then but a blot on the conscience of all of mankind? During World Refugee Year, we have an opportunity, each of us, to remove this blemish from the conscience of mankind.
On United Nations Day, 1959, you have heard Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, Miss Doris Day, Mr. Joseph Schildkraut, Mr. Gregory Peck. This program was brought to you by the United States Committee for the United Nations and came to you from UN headquarters in New York.
So, Volker Turk, what are your general impressions of this radio documentary, which, in a way, was an early podcast before the term was even invented?
Well, I'm very touched by, first of all, the humanity in it, the portrayal of the fate of someone who lives in a refugee camp in Europe at the time, which, by the way, is not dissimilar from, I'm sure, what a lot of people would say in today's refugee camps. The fact that they talk about a waiting period, which is indeed one of the big issues, especially in these institutionalized settlements where refugees are often confined, freedom of movement is restricted, and so forth. So I think what you hear and see and feel in this speaks very much to today's experience of refugees. It shows that it's a universal experience, that some of the issues we have moved on in some respects, but we also are still grappling with exactly the issue of finding a new home actually making sure that refugees can get on with their lives.
We hear Eleanor Roosevelt describe refugee camps as frightful places that she hoped would be obsolete by 1960, by the following year. But that obviously was not to be.
That was not to be. And in fact, in the last 15 years or so, there was a massive campaign, and I'm very grateful to the non-governmental organizations who launched it, about an end to warehousing of refugees. And I think there was really a very strong move towards saying, let's make and put an end to refugee settlements in the way that they are organized camps, because of not least what Eleanor Roosevelt describes in this interview. And we have seen some progress in this, but we still have massive refugee camps around the world. And we have certainly seen more attention paid towards refugees who live in urban areas, who live in rural areas, with policies that try to address their needs and try to respond to what they actually want to achieve in terms of aspirations. But we still have some refugee camps around the world. Look at Kenya, for example, Dadaab, one of the biggest, or in Jordan, or in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where indeed their lives are really confined. And Hungary was very fresh in the minds, I'm sure, of Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, waiting without knowing what the future will hold is unfortunately still today a huge experience that refugees face.
Then I suppose it was a fairly straightforward division between the West and communist countries, and there were just 14 million refugees at that point, and now we have over 60 million on the run in 2017.
Yes, so today we have 65 million people displaced as a result of conflict, persecution, human rights violations. I have to say that two-thirds of the 65 are internally displaced. There was not so much recognition in the past about internally displaced people, so clearly the international community has moved on, and today we have, in terms of numbers, quite a different situation. But actually, the actual content of it and what needs to be done for refugees has remained very much the same. It means that we need politicians, we need actors, we need the private sector, the academics, to be aware of them. And it was great to hear Doris Day, Gregory Peck in that audio to lend their voice to the refugee experience. And that is as important now as it was then.
Were you struck also by the difference in terms of the welcome? Obviously, in this case of the classic broadcast, it was the United States welcoming this 10-year-old boy.
That's the reset, if you like, the experience of refugees being resettled to a third country is one of the most fulfilling experiences that we certainly live, those of us who have worked for refugees for many years. It's a frightening moment, as you could hear from the child, from Janusz and his experience, because indeed, you don't know what the future holds. It is still a solution that is only available to very few refugees. Even less than 1% of the refugee population today has a chance to find resettlement places elsewhere. We were very lucky over the last couple of years to have seen an increase in resettlement places from 60 to 80 to 100,000. Even last year, it was over almost 140,000 people were resettled in third countries. The U.S. has played a leadership role in this regard. We have seen, unfortunately, that the quotas have lessened this year, but we hope very much that within the current discussion, including in the U.S., in Europe and elsewhere, that more countries will come forward, that they will see the value of it, providing a home to people who are the most vulnerable on earth, and on trying to bring, if you like, a beacon of hope into their lives. And the experience that we heard about from Janusz is one that, as a child, and probably his mother and his relatives, is very much the same that refugees today have when they hope for resettlement out of Kenya or out of Lebanon. We have today a whole list of people who had a refugee experience in their previous lives who have done enormously well and contributed to their societies. So it's also important that if we are able, as an international community, as a society, to respond to their needs, if we are successful in integration, for example, refugees will give back. And not just once, they will give back many, many times, and they will contribute enormously to a host society and to host countries. And I think it is important that we take that into account.
So for the Janoshes of today, sheltering outside the shattered walls of Mosul or Raqqa, is there real hope?
Of course, the immediate experience of someone who has just gone through the horrors of a Raqqa situation or a Mosul situation is absolutely devastating. But our experience is, having worked with refugees for many, many years, is that there is an incredible sense of strength and resilience and courage. We need to support that in whatever way we can, in a meaningful way and in a respectful way, and not, as we sometimes see in societies, with fear and prejudice and disrespect. We need to honor the human being that has ended up in the unfortunate situation of having lost everything, having lost their homes.
In many parts of the world, unfortunately, he would be shunned. That's just the reality of where we are now, isn't it?
Unfortunately, in many societies, not just in the industrialized world, also increasingly so in the global south, we see a tendency to view refugees and migrants as people who one needs to fear. And this is often the case where with people who have never actually seen or talked to refugees or to migrants. They seem to have this fear of the other, if you like, or fear of the foreigner. And it's often used, I'm afraid to say, by populist politicians as a means to gain votes or to stir up trouble. We really need to come together again within societies as a result not least of historical experiences. At the end of the Second World War, for example, where there was a very strong sense of a never again attitude, we don't want to repeat the horrors of the Second World War, and learn from these experiences and be respectful to the other, be respectful to the foreigner, be respectful to refugees. And I think that was one of the greatest achievements coming out of the United Nations in the early years, to recognize the refugee experience, to provide a legal status for them, to create an institution or institutions to protect them and to find solutions for them. And that experience is really sacrosanct in today's world, and we desperately need it, especially when societies squabble over this issue of how to deal with the foreigner or with refugees. There are ways and means to do it, to learn from this, so that we see it not as a crisis, but it as an opportunity that we can address and manage together if we are willing to do so, and if we are open to the richness and the diversity of humanity today.
That was Volker Türk, Assistant High Commissioner for Refugees, speaking to me from UNHCR's Geneva studio. This has been only the second of our UN News podcast classic episodes of The Lid Is On, and we've a big archive full of more extraordinary stories from the decades gone by. So more from us soon, and thanks for lending us your ears. I'm Matt Wells.